Hi guys, I am Casey with Student Activities, and I wanted to go ahead and invite up Lisa from the Alaska World of Affairs, and she's going to go over some stuff with you.
All these lights are bright. Hello, welcome everyone. My name is Lisa Falsco. I'm with the Alaska World Affairs Council, and I just wanted to say a couple words and thank UAA for allowing us to partner with UAA on this program and some other programs that we have throughout the year. And William Toyer is recording today's program for KSKA Radio. So if you want to hear this again or some of your friends weren't able to make it out, have them go on to alaskapublic.org to listen to this recording. And the Alaska World Affairs Council, we partner with organizations like UAA to bring speakers to Alaska to talk about various topics around the world. And these programs are held normally on Fridays at noon at the Hilton Hotel, and they are free for students. So if you are a student, we have a sponsorship from BP. It'll cover your lunch. You can come out and hear some great speakers, and I'm very excited about the speaker today. So thank you very much for coming, and back to you.
All right, we just wanted to go over some of the homecoming events that we have coming up next week. Next week we have Massive Monkeys on Monday. We're doing a little teaser at noon, and then we are going to have a show at 7:30 in the Student Union. And then on Wednesday we have our comedian Hannibal Burris at 7:30 in the Wendy. And then on Thursday we have the Acapella Festivella, and I believe that is at 7:30 as well. So again, come on out. It's have some fun for homecoming. Wear your school colors. And let's clap for Chris Dady.
I like that. You're clapping. You don't even know why. is that a light? All right, I'll read it this way. Good evening.
Good evening.
You can do better than that. Good evening.
Good evening.
There we go. None of that politeness. So this is being recorded for radio, and I will try not to swear, but I tend to do it a lot. So, you can edit. All right. Whew. So my name is Chris Abani. I'm a writer. I teach, I talk. So I guess I'm here to talk a little bit about narrative, I think, essentially, in relationship to the events you have going on, also in relationship to the World Council. Thank you, Lisa, and everyone else who brought me here. It's very nice. This is my first time in Alaska. All I know about you comes from television, and not even recent television. It's really one show. I think you all know it, right? They had a moose going through town. There was a doctor. Northern exposure. And that's probably in Canada even. I don't know. So, but I do know about the glory hole. There's apparently they're mining for gold up here. And there's a show in LA called The Soup that takes pleasure in making fun of these poor people. Who keep talking about the glory hole and apparently don't know what they're talking about. So, I told you, it's just going to get smuttier. it's very hard to be erudite when you're West African. It's just not in our nature. So, the thing is, also tomorrow I'm going to be working with some students in a workshop around the ideas of leadership, but also the notions of conflict and conflict management, sort of the ways in which we work through it. So I think at the core of all of this is really the idea of narrative and the ethics of narrative. So the notion that nothing exists outside of storytelling. That everything is essentially a story. And then we pick the stories we want to believe in, and then we invest them with truths that aren't necessarily true. And we will often die over things that we've made up, which is really fantastic. But the main thing about narrative that I love is the ways in which you have a sort of formal narrative and you have the informal narratives. And I love the informal narratives because they usually come from people who are living very difficult experiences every day. And they usually use humor to subvert that. I was in South Africa, I'm always there. And they have a wonderful joke that they tell. And if you've heard this before, I'm sorry. So basically, you don't know who Nelson Mandela was, right? Yeah. Just check in, man. You know, he doesn't have a Twitter page. So and so there was this thing called apartheid. And then it was over. And so Nelson Mandela's inauguration, everyone flies into for the event. And then it's a small plane leaving Pretoria and heading back into the homelands, as it were. It's a 7-8-seater plane. And it takes off, and there are only 2 black Africans on board. So about 40 minutes into the flight, one of the engines goes out. And so the captain comes on and says, ladies and gentlemen, we've lost an engine, and the plane is listing. So we have a couple of parachutes, and in the spirit of the new South Africa, we would like to ask for volunteers to jump off the plane. And nobody moves. And so he says, well, we'll just go alphabetically then. Will all the Africans please jump off the plane? And nobody moves. And so he says, well, will all the blacks please jump off the plane? And nobody moves. And so he says, well, will all the coloreds please jump off the plane? And nobody moves. And so this little boy who's with his dad, they're Zulu, he turns to his dad and says, Dad, if we're not African and we're not black and we're not colored, what are we? And he said, today, my son, we are Zulus. There is a way in which people, I find, that the hardest thing about narrative is, and all of it has to do with narratives of inclusion, narratives of exclusion, is that it's always most fraught when we can't be open about them, when we can't talk about what's difficult, when we can't talk about, or we can't sometimes laugh in the face of difficulty, where we're always policing not so much the intent, but rather the language, so that we always end up in these weird deadlocks. And in fact, the workshop tomorrow I'm going to do with the students, we've done at the World Economic Forum with multitudes of people, and one time we ran it with the Palestinian and Israeli delegation, and it's the only time we've been able to successfully negotiate a conflict-free situation, because, you know, they live that stuff all the time. They don't want to play games about it, so... Anyway, I'm going to read you a short essay. It's called The Writer and the Goat. And at the end of it, we'll do questions and answers, right? Right? Yes. This is how it works. When I say hello, you say hello back. When I say right, you go right. All right. So, and everything is open. I mean, I don't want you to feel like there are any questions you can't ask. So from the most difficult to the most frivolous, I live in Los Angeles, so I know a lot of gossip about Britney Spears. I know a lot of stuff, so we won't run out of conversation, trust me. The Writer and the Goat. Epigraph. Love for the weak always includes a certain murderous intent. Kobo Abe. Epigraph. Liberty is not the power of doing what we like, but the right to do what we ought to. Lord Acton. Let us not begin with definitions, with academic references, with proof that many books have been studied on the subject, with the notion that for an idea to be singular, purposeful, or even useful, it must be backed up by the research of others. Let us begin with a smaller gesture. If small things can defeat us, and they can if we're to believe the old Igbo proverbs about mosquitoes, then they're enough, perhaps, to hang so much upon. A cup of tea in a cold winter morning, or a story, perhaps. Imagine this, a young boy of 10 sets off down a village path to the stream, the path where animals are killed and dressed so that their offal washes away from everything holy. This boy has to become a man. He has to kill a goat. I was that boy. And there is nothing harder to do than to kill something. Actually, I tell a lie, cockroaches are the exception, but everything else dies hard and struggles to live. Imagine, if you will, the cry of a goat, so human that the Greeks named the process of their catharsis after it, and goat's eyes so very human. In Igbo culture, children are told when lost in the forest to seek a goat and follow it, as it will always lead back to habitation. Anyway, the story. And so I have to kill this goat, not much bigger than a kid to kill a kid. And this is the reality. It wasn't cruelty that demanded this of me. It was simply the reality of a culture that killed its own meat, coupled with that process of masculine initiation that demanded the sacrifice of innocence as its entrance. Of course, arguably, I wasn't that innocent, having already killed chickens and turkeys, but birds are dinosaurs, and they retain their reptilian evil. And I tell you, it's easy to kill reptiles. I'm just asking for it. But I didn't want to kill that goat. I wanted to read my new Silver Surfer comic in the shade of a mango tree. I wanted to hide behind the woodshed and drink Coca-Cola and smoke cigarettes. I wanted to do anything but kill that goat. It was a lonely walk down to the killing spot, dragging the reluctant, crying kid behind me. And the rules were simple. Kill and dress the kid alone. But then halfway to the river, out of sight of the elders, a familiar figure emerged from the underbrush. Emmanuel, my school friend and former boy soldier. Emmanuel was hard. He had seen many terrible things, even taken the lives of men. Yet here he was to help me with something as ordinary as killing a goat. And as I struggled to hold the animal down, my knees pinning its legs to the ground, my hands on its horns, pulling its throat back, ready for the bite of the knife, I froze as our eyes met and the goat cried. Tears welled, and Emmanuel, sensing I was about to fail this test, came over and with one hand covered the goat's eyes and with the other closed its mouth against its own cries. "Steady," he said. And such simple gestures, pedestrian even, but coming from someone like him who should have cared less whether I could kill a goat or not, they seemed to mean so much more. I was crying louder than the goat as I pulled my knife across its throat and held its head, draining the blood into the ritual pot. When Emmanuel let go, the goat's eyes were cloudy and the last blood gurgled through its lips. I jumped back. Emmanuel cleaned and dressed the goat as I sat in the corner crying. And when he was done, he came over to me and sat down. He lit a cigarette, sucked on it for a little bit, and then passed it to me and said, "Listen, it will always be hard to kill. But if you cry like this every time, you will die of heartbreak. Sometimes it is enough to know that it will be hard." And so until I began to write this essay, I had forgotten that though I killed maybe two goats in my entire life, my elder brother Charles had to undertake the responsibility of killing and dressing the goats we cooked for Christmas, for Easter, birthdays, and when we had special guests, which added up to quite a number. And until now, it never occurred to me to question whether this was hard for him. It might have been harder for him. Charles had always loved animals. As a kid, he took in stray cats and dogs and even built my sister and me a toy zoo complete with a lizard for a crocodile. And Charles had a cat that got bitten by a snake and died in the backyard, crying horribly and foaming at the mouth. And we all gathered to watch it with different degrees of fascination and repulsion, but Charles held the dying animal. And the look on his face comes easily to me as I write this, even though it has been over 30 years. Every writer thinks he feels things the most, that he's somehow special because he gets to narrate the world to everyone else as though they aren't living in it. Pride is one of the deadly sins that writers commit every time we put pen to paper, turn our minds to narrative. A lot has happened between then and now, a lot of blood and not all of it animal. The thing is this, my knowledge of blood, of the terrible intimacy of killing, has taught me that though I have never killed a man, I know how to. I know I could. The only thing that terrifies me is that I may not feel sorry. And even as I make this terrible confession, what can it mean? What does the moment offer? Affirmation of something already suspected or something else, a recognition perhaps that we all stand at the edge of the same abyss. And this is what the art I make requires of me, that in order to have an honest conversation with a reader, I must reveal myself in all my vulnerability. Reveal myself not in the sense of my autobiography, but in the sense of the deeper self, the one we keep hidden even from ourselves. And this revelation is not designed to engender sympathy or compassion or even pity. These, while generous on the part of the reader, obscure the deeper intent, the deeper possibility. The point is to dissolve oneself into the journey of the protagonist, to face the most terrifying thing in narrative, the thing that has been at its heart since the earliest campfire and story, to dare ourselves to imagine, to conjure up and then face all of our darkness and all of our light simultaneously, to stand in that liminal moment when we have no solid ground beneath us, no clear firmament above, no moral order we can trust, that we stand on the ambiguity of our nature and we see what we are truly capable of on both sides. The intensity of that confrontation is the only gift the writer has to offer, the only redemption that is possible in the end. And this is perhaps the awe of us, that we as human beings undertake to juggle this dialectic all the time. To accept this is the hardest part, to accept that all acts, every intervention we make in the world requires judgment, and that judgment by its very nature conjures up the specter of shame, and that between these two things, so far, the only language we have of defining ourselves does violence to another. Epigraph. Like a piece of ice on a hot stove, the poem must ride on its own melting. Robert Frost. We have wrestled with this question of our humanity since the first human pointed to a star and saw that his or her finger was not connected to the night sky. Our humanity, this humanness, is something we still cannot fully define. It is, in fact, more like a black hole. We know it is there simply by observing and charting the phenomenon of our reactions. Wise ones amongst us know that it is the sum of all the play and field and the phenomenon and the black hole, but we are not all wise, at least I am not. And while this knowledge can be present in its academic sense, I am only able to embody it once in a while. But to stretch this physics analogy, the measuring of a black hole entails the elimination of phenomenon one at a time. And so in this way, we as humans, in measuring our humanness, must remove this phenomenon or add them depending on our worldview. And what if we think of this phenomenon for a moment as facades or the masks of identity, and there's so many that we layer upon whatever is human about us to be seen in the world? I think then we can all agree that even though we don't know exactly what humanness is, we know that being human, the process itself, forces us to release these masks that we hide behind, masks that we believe we cannot live without, even though we realize it is impossible to go on living behind them. These masks have many names but share very similar archetypal origins regardless of where in the world we come from: fear, hate, pain, love, jealousy, self-loathing, and so on. This is what I know about being human, that we all desire to live without fear or disease or affliction, but that we all refuse to give up our crutches. And James Baldwin says it better, as Jimmy always did. He says, I imagine one of the reasons people cling to their hate so stubbornly is because they sense once their hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with their pain. In making my art, and sometimes when I teach, I am like a crazed, spirit-filled, a snake handling, speaking in tongues, spell-casting, Babylon chanting down, New Age evangelical preacher, wildly kicking the crutches away from my characters and my students, forcing them into their pain and potential transformation. Alas, or maybe not, I also kick the crutches away from my readers, and many of them have fled from the revival tents of my art, screaming in terror. And what of compassion, you might ask? Is that the measure of it? Aristotle liked conditions, and he listed three that must exist before compassion can take place. One, that a serious and bad thing has happened to somebody other than us. Two, that this bad event was not, or at least not entirely, that person's own fault. Three, that we know ourselves to be vulnerable in the same way to the same thing. Baldwin said, and I paraphrase, your suffering means something only in so much as someone else can attach his or her suffering to yours. He offered this as a point for young writers to find ways to make their work compelling, but I think it speaks often to us and our general tendencies towards the relational, towards the idea that there are things we cannot relate to, that there are things beyond our imagining. And this is not true. This is what marks the difference between compassionate and empathetic people. Compassionate people always come up to you and say, "I'm sorry, I cannot imagine your pain." But what they're really saying is, "I don't want to. Stay away from me. You're contaminated." French writer Marguerite Yourcenar says this: "Compassion emphasizes the experience of suffering with those who suffer, and it is far from according a sentimental conception of life. It inflicts its knife-like pain only on those who, strong or not, brave or not, intelligent or not, have been granted the humble gift of looking the world in the face and seeing it as it is." But I wonder sometimes, what if what she really speaks about is empathy? And what if we change this idea of a gift to a choice? What if compassion, true compassion, requires not the gift to see the world as it is, but perhaps a choice to be open to seeing the world as it can be? This is my hope, to create an art that can catalog the phenomenon of our nature, all of it, without sentimentality, but rather leaning into transformation, so as to offer up what Diane Arbus would call the veritable, the inevitable, or the possible, so that we can all have that terrible but necessary confrontation with all of ourselves, and that I can make it possible for that to occur outside of judgment. I still have not found how to do that. When I was a younger man, I was engaged in an ideological war with the Nigerian dictatorships under which we lived, and I use the plural because there were many coups and counter-coups and many governments were replaced, but they all had one common denominator. They were dictatorships. Upper middle class, educated, privileged, although not bulletproof, I campaigned tirelessly to organize protests to rid us of that oppression. I marched with the people I helped to organize, mostly poor, working class, or yet to be working class citizens. We faced down riot police and tear gas and beatings and bullets together, with nothing more than songs and the uncrushable belief that nothing good could ever die. But many did die, and I paid a little attention. And I speak only for myself here, and not the many good and wonderful thousands of other Nigerians engaged in that struggle with me. But for me, I hardly questioned my privilege and my right to organize these people. Any questions that did come up, I rationalized them. Had I not myself been imprisoned, had I not myself faced beatings and bullets, I was engaged in a righteous, righteous war. And now I have to ask myself if I had the right to place others in harm's way in the battle for our country's soul. And it is not because I have regrets, and it is not because I suffer from survivor's guilt. It is simply that I have to accept this discomfort, that being human, taking any action, requires always the ambiguity of doubt. Would I do it again? Most certainly. Would I feel this conflicted again? Definitely. I have no answers. I have no crutches. I told you the terms at the beginning. But let us return to the small things, the stories that hold all this transformation that I'm trying to articulate, because they are far more reliable than anything I can say. As a child growing up in post-Civil War Nigeria, I had the unique opportunity to spend time working on the rice fields that my father owned. I say it was a unique opportunity because farm work, particularly the growing of rice, was considered women's work. But my father wanted us to learn everything about our culture, and so even as a boy, I was free to take part. And I remember that as the women planted rice, they would sing mournful songs, dirges that were made up of the names of everyone in the town that had died during the Civil War, as though these women could somehow seed the souls of the dead into the tender shoots of green they threaded through the mud of the rice fields. I learned the songs and I sang along with them, threading back bent. And months later, as we harvested the rice, the women would sing happy songs. And woven through them would be the names of all the babies born that year. And the following planting season, we went back to the dirges. I had always assumed the songs were fixed seasonal ditties designed to make the work easier, but later I learned that this tradition was new and began just after the Civil War, and that far from being seasonal, these songs were in fact magical. I began to notice that the number of the dead who appeared in the dirges dropped in proportion to the number of births the following year. And this wasn't a simple belief in reincarnation, but the palpable and powerful transformation of sorrow and pain and even an underlying anger and hate into absolute redemption. These women, quietly, textually, and bodily, in their own way, were changing the narrative of the world. Writing Song for Night, my last novella, was a strange journey. It is a quest story, and part of the quest is a spiritual one, as the protagonist looks for a way to accept death. The month before its US debut, the publisher sent me finished copies. I was in Thailand teaching when they arrived. I went out with some students to celebrate when I got a call that my mother had just had a heart attack. I rushed to England to see her. The first thing she did was to grab the book and start to devour it greedily. And when she got tired, she asked my brother Greg to read it to her. I spent 10 days with her before heading back to the US. A couple of days later, before my plane left Los Angeles for a gig in New York, my mother called. She was too tired to finish the book, she said, but wanted to know if the protagonist, my luck, ever made peace with death. Yes, I said, he did. I'm glad, she said. She died the next day. And this sometimes happens to us, that we write the song that sings our mother across to the other side, that the narrative is beyond even the ethical work we wanted it to be, that it is sometimes only just a good story, that it sometimes brings comfort to others, and that it sometimes can make people proud. It doesn't matter in the end. Integrity will find its own way. Epigraph. Terror is a state of complete understanding. Larry Levis. As terrible as things we see might be, perhaps more terrifying are the things that once seen cannot be unseen. This is a difficulty I think we all recognize in the most instinctual ways, and perhaps this is why we all look away as often as we do from the things that have the power to unmake us. And if you do not, I must confess I do this in every way, in every day. When there is a flood in Burma, I change the channel. When there are too many people starving in a part of the world, I quickly leave the room. When there is an accident on the freeway, I'm perhaps the only one not rubbernecking. When the video of Daniel Pearl being beheaded came out, I was perhaps one of the few people who did not watch that. But what if you cannot look away? What if you have to arrive at a tree, a lynching tree, in Nigeria, in the Sudan, in the Carolinas, it doesn't matter. And there is the burnt husk of a person, not male, perhaps because his genitals have been cut away, or because it was a woman to begin with, it doesn't matter. This body before the torture, before the fire, before the dying, this person you have come to meet, this being, this no longer human, this body is no stranger to you. This is someone you loved. Someone whose smile you can still imagine under the crinkle of the crackled skin. So what do you do with all that anger, all that rage that burns through you? What do they do in Sarajevo? What do the Serbians do? How do you not pass this on to your kin, if not in words, then in blood? In the silence of the heart where unknowable things become illuminated, even in the silence of the heart. The point of the purposeful narrative, of the ethical narrative, is to draw all of the courage, kindness, goodness, and hope from the world, and all of the darkness and hate and pain and death into the open, where we can all share it and hopefully transform it. To be human requires no action. What is required, though, is much harder. It is a non-judgmental, and by this I don't mean non-discerning, daily accounting of our lives and our narratives to ourselves. It is owning all the power and privilege we have wielded that day and its true costs. And let me tell you, my friends, privilege is a tricky thing. because not having privilege can be a privilege wielded against those you think have privilege. And in this way, we all use this weapon. Perhaps this is what makes my work hard and human, a difficulty I disguise in beautiful language like any good lover knows to do. One of my earliest spiritual advisors told me that to be human is to accept that there will never be world peace, but to live my life as though it were possible. And this is the core of my aesthetic, the core of the work I write, the core of the teaching I do, is a belief in a deeper humanness that is beyond race, class, agenda, and power, even as I know that it is not possible. And yet, I strive for it in every day and in every way. Most particularly, I think, I find it when I fail. In the end, we may never know. Perhaps it is enough, as Emmanuel said, to know that it will always be hard. May you cry, but may you never die of heartbreak. Thank you. So let's talk about the Jersey Shore. I can't really see you, so if you have a question, you kind of have to. Any questions? Yes, please.
Is English your first language?
Yes. Well, my mother... I'm a bizarre... I was just talking about this with my two new friends at the front. My mother was a white English woman. My father is a black Nigerian. So subsequently, the only two things I have never been mistaken for is Nigerian and white. But everywhere I go, I'm either Maori or Arabic or Indian or... Actually, I've never been mistaken for Japanese, but you never know. I've never been, so that could still happen. So in that way, English was a first language, but also so was Igbo, which was my father's language. So I grew up bilingual in that way. But also growing up as a kid in Nigeria in the 70s, I grew up... So when I was born just as the Civil War was starting, and then it took us 2 years to finally make it through the country and get out to England. So I came back as a 5 or 6 year old just after the war and went to primary school with boys who had been boy soldiers, etc. But so a lot of the young teachers had died in this war. So a lot of my teachers came from the Philippines, from Malaysia, from India. In fact, from when I was 7 to when I was 9, my English teacher was Indian with a very, very heavy Indian accent. And so everyone in the small town I grew up with, which was between the ages of 7 and 9, spoke English like that all the time. This is just what we did. We didn't know any better. And so it's a truly wonderful thing. It's also while that's happening, all the Bollywood movies, you're watching those. You're watching American movies. And so so much of your cultural landscape is not only multilingual, it's multicultural. But in a way in which there's an honesty in the third world, which I don't really miss, I have to say. But if you have any third world connections... So like when I was a kid growing up, you can see I'm not exactly skinny, but if you just do that, you can imagine it looked worse when I was like... People would just come up to me like, why are you fat? And I'd be like, dude, that hurt. I'd lose weight then. Or people, you'd have a haircut. My mom used to cut our hair when we were kids. And people just come up and be like, well, what happened to you? Who did that to you? And so people in the third world just say things. They don't think about, they don't weight it with with a lot of the considerations that we weight things. And so that there's a beauty to that, but there's also a real setback to that. So for me, what's really interesting about that is how do you take that kind of honesty but position it in a way where it's not a cudgel, but it can be a way to just directly open up conversations. Because like there are no kids, and I was just saying that when I was in India, my name, last name is Abani, and it's a very common name in the Bengali parts of India, Abani Patel, Abani Patra. And when I travel, I do this eternal immigrant thing where I mimic the people that are talking to me. So like if I'm at work, if I'm at home all day working and I don't talk to anyone, the first time I speak, I always sound like that, you see, because that's how my mother sounded. But other than that, I mimic people. And it's very hard to be in India saying to people that you don't speak Urdu when you sound like you actually could be speaking Urdu. So I really don't know anymore what my languages were. There's also the language of television. There's the language of comic books. I grew up in a small town, non-hierarchical reading. In the library, I just read whatever there was there. So I would read the Dostoevskys and the Bhagavad Gita and then the Silver Surfer and then Spider-Man. And then I got sent to Catholic... I got sent to seminary to be a Catholic priest, so then there was Latin and Greek and so. So I don't know anymore. But I don't know if that helps you at all. It just shows you how confused I am. And there was a hand up there, yes. It's been a... Mm-hmm.
And just another part of that is, because the country has, like, significant oil wealth.
Has what?
Like, a lot of oil
wealth. Mm-hmm.
And I'm just curious to see what your opinion on why the stratification of that wealth is controlled by such a small amount of people.
Yeah, well... I haven't really been back to Nigeria since... It's been almost 20 years, so it's been a long time. But the beautiful thing, you know... Nigerians, I'm sure you all have a Nigerian story, right? Or you got an email from someone. Yeah, come on. There's no need to be pretending. Right? So we're like the New Yorkers of that planet, of that continent. We're very East Coasty, very aggressive people. And Nigerians think that you know, it's really funny. I was trying to explain this to someone about the way racism doesn't really... Nigerians think outside of racism. Because Nigerians actually think they're superior to everybody. So the notion... They have names for... They have... Like, that's the classification for whiteness in Nigeria. There is... a white person is a person who speaks English. Gofanti means you're European, like Italian, so you don't really speak English. And when I was a kid, people say, so your mother, is she white or Gofanti white? Right? So naturally, what then happens is that Nigerians tend to do one of two things. They stay in Nigeria and sneer at the rest of the continent, or we go west and then spend money. And so not being able to return to Nigeria has actually opened up the continent of Africa to me in ways it would never have done before. So I've actually been to more countries and experienced more of that entire continent than I would have if I had the chance to just go back to that one country, if that makes any sense. Yes, we have a lot of oil wealth. And what happens is when you have illiterate soldiers at the time... in charge of a government, they don't really know how to spend the money. I tell you, in 1973, they decided to rebuild the capital of Lagos. It actually looks more like Dubai, and they were doing this. So, you know, freeways would come up overnight, skyscrapers. They bought so much cement that the ships in the harbor couldn't wait to offload them, so they started dumping the cement into the ocean. So there's an actual artificial... continental shelf in Nigeria made up of dumped cement from ships. This is how we spent the oil money. It's also hard to imagine if all you know about Africa comes from Animal Planet or Disney. Caveat, I work for Disney now, so I can't really be dissing them. But because they're the corporation, they'll have me assassinated. But what I'm trying to say is that something that doesn't get talked about is the way class operates in Africa, right? That there is a very clear middle class, and there's very clear... The fact, not only do you have a working class, but there are people who are at such a subsistence level of living that you can't even call them working class. And so the educated are the elite. They're the middle classes. They're people like me. And we're actually the problem for the continent because we want to live... We want Starbucks everywhere. We want cell phones. In fact, you know, the new iPad... Someone in Nigeria spent... $15,000 to buy the new iPad before it came out in America. This is just how we roll, right? So the problem with that is that there's no infrastructure to support that kind of lifestyle. So then basically what you then need to support that lifestyle is to continue to spend, right? And so you're spent. So essentially what we went through is what's starting to happen to your country now, right? So what's happening to America, or at least for the 8 years before, you know, Obama came in, right? That we don't talk about. Because clearly he's the one that did everything. He fucked this country up. But we're now at a point where we, you know, when I came here, we're dangerously scooting down that direction where if the infrastructure to support a certain lifestyle doesn't exist, then you have to, you suddenly, the economy starts to feed on itself. You know? And that's what happened to Nigeria. So now we've had a democracy for maybe about 12, 15 years. But it takes a long time, because when the democracy first was available, people were hungry, so they would sell their votes. It's what you do when you're hungry. And also, if you've lived under a systemized brutality of a dictatorship, you start to believe that what you have to say doesn't matter. And so it's taken us a long time for the average Nigerian to trust the electoral process, to believe that they can actually change their country. And in the last 5 years, there's been a complete turnaround. You know, we're listed. We actually have, in addition to the internet fraud that you're all aware of, we have lots of companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange, for instance. So there's a slow turnaround, but it takes a long time. I mean, you know, in America, you're still struggling with voter registration issues and trying to convince people that it's important to vote. And you've been doing that much longer, right? So you can imagine what we face. Does that answer the question? So I'm optimistic. Yes, sir.
Earlier in the speech, you said something that really touched me. Sima and also confession and a question also. See, my father met that late teacher in Sudan. So I resemble him to the United Nations, but I'm over here. Sometimes I can't come to terms with that reality. Now the question is, when you was a political prisoner, what helped you
I think let me tell you a story that kind of will illustrate this, because I think that for me, and much of my experience around difficulty, is actually that the human spirit is most powerful around difficulty. During the Biafran War, I told you we eventually got out, so you can imagine my mother is 5'2" white English woman with 5 black babies. And so we end up in Portugal, first of all, for a while, because we can't get papers to go back to England. And so we're at the airport, and we were waiting at the airport for this flight over and over again. And finally, this Englishwoman who was on holiday in the Algarve came over to my mother and asked her why, because she had this one African print dress that was faded and flip-flops. And my mother used to wash it. We were staying in a convent, and she used to wash it every night and hang it up to dry and sleep naked. So we had nothing. And this woman, when my mother told her we had come out of Biafra, this woman sort of emptied her entire suitcase and gave us all her clothes. And so for the entire time, the entire 2 years of this war, where my sister had been born in a hospital that was being bombed, my mother had never cried, but she cried then. And I was like, I remember it distinctly. I was like 2.5. And so years later, when I was writing about that, I asked my mother, and she said to me, you know, the thing is that it's easy to seal your heart against difficult things, but unexpected kindnesses are what unstitches you, right? And so it's not coming to terms with imprisonment or terror that's difficult. It's actually coming to terms with it not being your identity anymore. That's the hardest thing. And I don't know. I struggle with that all the time. I think everybody does, everybody who's been there. You know, a whole generation of Americans who fought in the Second World War died and never really talked about. They were very reluctant to talk about the trauma they had seen. Vietnam, the same. We've seen it again. That it's actually easier when they're in the war, and when they come home, it's harder, because there's no place for that anymore. You know, and so that's really what's difficult. And then there's, like you said, it's always complicated. And this is why race, when you grow up in Nigeria, where race operates in this kind of the sense of global whiteness and global capital, but not directly, because everyone who has power is black, essentially. I mean, biracial kids are in the minority. To come to Europe and when I was like 26 or 27 to live and to encounter that level of racism is a very difficult thing, to see the people who look like your mother treat you like an animal and still be able to not take that out on your mother. You see what I'm trying to say? So these narratives are difficult, and the thing is, I think the biggest problem we face, particularly I think in a contemporary Western culture, is always the need to erase difficulty, to pretend difficulty away, to protect children from difficulty, to protect ourselves from difficulty, as though that somehow burying our head in the sand means that the difficulty doesn't exist. All I know how to do is to sit with difficulty. I don't have any answers, but I know that it's better than but Tenen is not there. And it has to do also, I mean, in Africa, we have a different relationship to healing. In the West, healing means the erasure of trauma, right? Which is what we all hope therapy is going to do for us, that we'll never remember all the bad things about our parents. But, you know, but every time we go to Thanksgiving, you know, we still end up throwing turkey legs at each other. So clearly, it doesn't work. Whereas in Africa, I think we come to terms with the notion that healing is learning to live with these damaged parts of yourself, but in a non-damaging way to others. In other words, learning to reintegrate all this difficulty and just knowing that sometimes, like Emmanuel said, it's just hard and that that's okay. I think the problem is when we expect it not to be hard. And there's a tremendous amount of pressure externally, particularly here, to not, to always be happy, to feel like we can't complain, and we get into these bizarre games of hierarchies of pain, who suffered more, who suffered less, and it doesn't matter, man, you know? Like some, if we get into that, I don't, you know, I mean, really, if you've had a kid, has anyone really suffered more than labor? Really? Think about it. So, I mean, we can't, these things become unproductive ways of having conversations. And so for me, what I always try to do is remain in that moment of difficulty, but always keep showing apertures that exist that we can transcend it. But transcendence does not mean to forget that thing. It's to learn from that thing. So it'll always be difficult, I'm sorry. But the fact that you can even talk about it means you're much more wholesome than you think you are. You know, it's like if you say to people, man, I drink way too much, you're probably not drinking as much as you think. Because if you're really drinking too much, you don't know you're drinking too much. So other people are the ones who have to say, man, you drink a lot, you know? This is the same way everyone who says I'm cynical, they're not cynical. That just defeats the whole point of being cynical, because cynics are not aware that they're cynical. They're just fucked up people. So, you know what I mean? Yeah. Any other questions? Yes. Well, yeah, this is a good... Well, okay, it always starts with the person who teaches you to read. And so this is what happens. I have three elder brothers, and then there was a break of 4 years where my parents were apparently wanted a girl and had lots of mass said and novenas were prayed and much candles were lit in the Catholic Church. And then I turned up. Which I suppose is God's sense of humor, right? But there was a way in which I think I wasn't. My mother almost died giving birth to me. Or apparently, almost. You know, I don't remember this. But I think my mother just always felt that there was something odd about me. I guess she was right because I'm pretty odd. But she taught me to read when I was 2. And so when I was 5, I was doing. I had to do. My brother Greg was 9. I was doing his homework for cigarettes. And so she found out, but I was writing his essays, and so I guess I did, and my mother wrote a lot, you know, she wrote letters and she had diaries, but, you know, my mother made us write to our grandmother, who lived in England all the time, but we couldn't just write one page, we had to write these letters describing things, and so I guess there was that. But I think that for me, like I said, I was pretty odd. So I was reading books at an age when most people don't read those books. So I think I read Baldwin's Another Country when I was 10. And at the time, you know, it says in a seminary to be a priest, I didn't really see the homosexual parts of the book. So I didn't understand the outrage because that got me in trouble in seminary for reading that book. But what I did realize is something that I only learned to articulate later, which was that I think is at the heart of everything James Baldwin wrote, which is that the only aberration in this world is the absence of love, right? And so in that way, but that was also a book about being a writer. And so I think between my mother and James Baldwin, I ended up wanting to be a writer, which is kind of one of those miraculous things about literature, because you have to imagine Baldwin is an exile from America for being gay and black, living in France, writing a book that will then change the life of an African boy 15 years afterwards. And this is what's remarkable about art and the artistic endeavor, is that there's no boundaries. You cannot contain any way in which the human spirit exists. And so that inspires me all the time. Reggaeton inspires me. The idea that people take raga music, mix it with salsa and mariachi music and come up with hip hop, right? This constant notion that we will always find ways to articulate the human spirit. That inspires me all the time. Young people inspire me. My students inspire me to be a writer. Because sometimes, you know, they stumble upon really transformational moments that they don't see what you saw. And so it's what a wonderful thing to see that, you know. So all the time, everything inspires me. But also, I think primarily I'm a gossip. And I think all good writers are gossips, man. We just... You can't write well if you don't like to hear shit about other people. I'm sorry. Even if you don't pass it on, you always want to hear stuff. So you're always eavesdropping. You're always putting your nose where it doesn't quite belong. You're always asking people odd questions like, yeah, so what's the deal with John, right? And then just, and they keep talking like, And you make notes and use it later. My family don't tell me stories anymore. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Why do you do what you do? I mean, to be honest, it's the first time I knew you. And you said you have a good time. I hear it. I hear it still. Are you, you're still connected to Africa. I think it's a question about what do you want to achieve? What would you want me to leave the room with thinking about?
What I want you to leave the room thinking about? I want you to leave the room thinking that actually we're more alike we're alike in more ways than we are different. And this is true of everybody. I think that I want you to leave the room and not deny the effects of things like racism, but to, if possible, encounter people one-on-one as individuals. Or let them demonstrate themselves before. I want you to leave the room and not be afraid of anything. Like to just, I'm sorry about the radio, but to just really not give a fuck about judgment, about what people think about you. To do the things that make you happy, just because they make you happy. And I don't mean like robbing a bank, but I mean you could, but you'd probably get shot. But I mean like, I have graduate students, white and black, up middle class and working class, who have never been to a museum. Like I take them to the museum and it comes out over coffee that they, why? See, you're a nerd. Why are you pretending you're not? Like, be happy, and also stop striving to be happy in this way that we, you know, it's in the Constitution. Be happy, like the moral imperative to be happy. You know, life sucks sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't. But to be human, to not have to, even if you have to lie about who you are to other people, just not to yourself. Just not to yourself. Because it's just hard enough living in, on a day-to-day when you have to, we do have to have filters. And, you know, luckily I'm privileged in many ways because being a writer, being a public intellectual, you're almost always in this liminal space where it's permissible. I can come here and say fuck and go home, right? But if I taught here, maybe not so much. Right, so I want you to also be able to acknowledge what power and what privilege you have, and so that you are always in control of the narratives you are making, and to be aware of the narratives you're making in your head all the time. That's really all I want people to do, because that's the only way to stop bullshit, right? So that you know. So, I mean, I don't know if you're like me, but you know, when I go on first dates, I don't tell people that I snore or that. You know, you don't tell them, yeah, I'm on medication for being slightly bipolar. I'm not, but I just wouldn't. Do you know what I mean? Like, you don't just go or hang out. I'm just not what I'm saying. But at the same time, you know, like anyone on a date knows, that there is a sort of a process of revelation, but you're aware of the process of revelation. So if you lived your life always in this notion that there are different stories that you are sitting in at different times, you choose that you can stop narratives that you've been living that are not serving you, that interfere with how you want to interact with people all the time. That's really all I want. And the only way to do that is to be honest, just to be direct. And this is one thing I learned from Baldwin, that if you are, and this is why he said your suffering means something only in so much as someone else can connect theirs to yours. If you cannot be vulnerable, you cannot ask anyone else to be vulnerable. It's just not right. Right? So even in my classrooms, it's intense sometimes because I actually let my students, because I push them hard, so I let them push back. And I don't think they often have the chance to do that. But not everyone can do that. But all I'm asking is for awareness, just to be aware, and to just try and live not an honest life in a moral sense, but an honest life in an ethical sense, where you're always aware of the decisions you're making and why you're making them. So you can always be free. That's all freedom really is being aware of the stories you tell yourself. Does that make any sense? That's all. That's why I let it all hang out, so to speak. Oh, I haven't. Yeah, well, you know, I haven't been to Nigeria, but I've been to. But I also go to other parts. So, well, for instance, in South Africa, we work in the Westville prison, right outside of Durban. We run workshops for prisoners. There are workshops for street kids in different countries. We have projects in Egypt where we do that. We have one shelf libraries in Ethiopia. There's lots of things that I tangentially get involved in all the time. I'm off to the Philippines in November. We're going to be doing some stuff there with some kids. I did that. That's what I was doing in Thailand, both in Chiang Mai and in Bangkok, working with transsexual prostitutes to be able to create their own narratives and to be able to articulate their own pain so that no one else is controlling that narrative for them. It's hard for me. It's so easy for me. This is always the thing that I struggle with, and I think we all struggle with it. You know, every human being is operating through the world with some kind of prejudice. Some kind of prejudice. Even if you just think the people who drink wine are elitist, right? Or people who go to the Mac store, whatever. We're all working with some level of prejudice. And so I know how easy it is for me to slip into ways of casting people or ways of trying to make some things more important than other things. And I want to resist that. I really want to try to be a human, just primarily a human being in the world, and interact with people as a human being, regardless of whether they accept that or not. And so I don't want to get into those narratives, because I also do a lot of work in Wisconsin with prisoners, right? In Angola, the prison in the south. So I'm not in... Countries terrify me, right? And the more resources get limited, the more the notion of countries and that kind of one way of seeing the world terrifies me even more. Some of us have to at least not believe in that. I mean, it's important that we have boundaries. You know what I mean? Otherwise, if you didn't, all the Nigerians would move in here and you'd all move out. It's as simple as that. But what I'm trying to say is that as much as I can, I always want to be able to believe that other things are possible. That it is, even if the reality is denying it to me, it's important to me in how I want to be a human being to always believe it's possible. And so it's less even about other people, it's more about my own journeys through my own self. You know, the beautiful thing about being a writer is that you're privileged that people go on that journey with you sometimes when they read your work or they listen to you speak, that because you have to think how many people are going through that journey, how many people that we dismiss after a tornado rips through a trailer park, how many of those people whose trailers weren't affected taking the kids of the people. Do you see what I'm trying to get at? Everyday people are living these incredibly human lives, but they just don't get to talk about them. That touches me in profound ways. You know, Oprah, I know, Oprah. I love Oprah, you know. I watch a lot of bad television, but I remember watching one of Oprah's Angel Network things, and she'd given all this money to these women in the south side of Chicago who used to just go into families that had, well, just adopted crack babies literally from the street, old retired black women with no help from the government. They were just doing it out of their pensions until Oprah suddenly decides to give them this money and this support. And I just always ask myself that, like, is somebody alive today because of me? Like, what difference does anything I do or think? What real impact, I don't mean rhetorical impact, I mean like real impact in the world. So that's what drives me, not where it should be done or for whom it should be done, or actually who thinks I should be doing it for whom, if that makes any sense. Yeah. One last question. Yes, sir. Okay, there's three. I'll take all those questions. Yeah. they all went up at the same time. The students in Nigeria who did what?
The 25 students that was learning.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I want to say that this is the first time it's happened, but I would be lying to you. I feel very strongly about it. So when you grow up under a dictatorship, there is so much that happens that can never be talked about. For instance, the military decided to silence journalists in Nigeria in 92, and they instituted something called Decree 2 and backdated it to the 70s so they could arrest any current journalist who'd ever criticize the government, that they weren't even the government at the time. So they could just arrest people. Now, in Nigeria, these terrible things still happen, like there's murder everywhere. But at least people are being held accountable in ways that they weren't being held accountable before. And that is a tremendous shift in consciousness. And so I feel like hopefully the more attention and sort of real action that happens, forget the international community, within the Nigerian community, the less that will ever happen again. So I remain hopeful. We had a whole Occupy Nigeria, and I tell you, when I was young, that would have just, you would have been watching them on the news, just driving tanks through those people. But that didn't happen this time. Certainly a significant, it doesn't seem like it, but real significant change is happening. You know?
So what if you have a reason, what is the underlying reason why you haven't been back to Nigeria?
The underlying reason? My family don't. My immediate family don't live there anymore. My father passed 11 years ago. My brothers and sister all live in South Africa, London, Egypt, different places. So, the pull to go back, because most of the time when you return to your home country, you're returning from nostalgia. I have no financial needs there, so it would be to return to my childhood. But my childhood is available in other places. That's really the only reason. I'm free to go back anytime I want to. So there's no... I grew up there for 26 years. I think that's enough time to spend in one place. And like, you know, I mean, when I say grew up there, like I'm a Nigerian in the way that many Nigerians can never be a Nigerian. Like speak Igbo, Yoruba, Hausa, every kind of pidgin English. I was Nigerian to the core. As my brother says to me, sometimes I would say something, he says, remarkable you even speak English. So I don't miss it in that way. So there's no urge. But there's so much I haven't seen. So many places I haven't been to. So that's the only reason. I love Nigeria. But, you know, it's like when you love your parents. You only go home at Christmas. Sometimes not even then. And there was one last. Is that yes?
Yeah. How important is it that we all know our own narratives and share with each other?
It's extremely important because that's the only way you can actually build a community. Because you know, I'm also a poet and I hang around poets all the time. I'm always building communities. And in America, the word when you say this is my community, it means these are the people who agree with me. It's not a community. Those are people that's your posse, the people who agree with you. Imagine if you live in Jerusalem and your next door neighbor is an extremely radical Jewish person who believes that the Israeli state is oppressive. And next to him is an Arab whose family have lived there for generations who is now facing an eviction. And next to that is a very reactionary Israeli who thinks nobody else should be in Jerusalem. And next to that is an Ethiopian Jew who people won't even accept is Jewish. And they all live on the same street and they have to go to the same... That's a community, man. Because you just have to confront difficulty every single day. Like, you can't, everything becomes a problem. Everything is a problem. Buying milk is a problem. And so the only way to sustain that without degenerating into complete violence, which is what people in those places do, is they talk honestly to each other. They talk openly to each other. I don't mean in abusive terms. I just mean just like there is an honesty that is missing for most of us. Because community means difficulty. And we, that's why we move to suburbs and we have gated communities, so we don't have to have community. Right? And it's a big problem for us. And we all, but the deep thing is, we all fundamentally crave it. We all fundamentally want it. And we get it in superficial ways. People go to churches where it's, of course, a mixed bag of people, but then you never really hang out with those people. So I think everyone craves it. And it's only, and when you know that people crave community in America, is when there's a tragedy that happens. And you see people you don't expect to see doing things you don't expect them to do. Like during Katrina, I can't tell you how many everyday Americans just went to New Orleans to do stuff that they didn't have to. Like, people want to be involved with each other. Oftentimes we feel we're not allowed. It's often, you know, it's like in apartheid South Africa. You know, it's a difficult question to talk about, but they talk about it much more honestly there, because race is much more fraught and much more everyday, and it's classified in clear ways that it's not even classified. Even you have, not only are you Cape, so not only are you colored, which means you're a mix of some kind, but you could be Cape colored, which means you're from the Cape. But Cape colored blue means you have blue eyes. So we'll be having a conversation with my friend who's Zulu, and I'll ask about my friend Gail, who's a Cape colored blue. And she's like, those Cape colored blues, don't pay any attention. You know, so constantly people are navigating this difficulty. There are museums to apartheid. Like, people go there. When you go to South Africa, you'd be shocked at actually how many people, children of people who enacted apartheid, go to those museums, because that history has been denied to them too. Like, there are ways in which so many white South Africans have come to realize that they were never free under apartheid. How can you be free if you can't choose your own friends? You want to be friends with a black person, but you can't. You want to marry a black woman, but you can't. But you're free. You're not free. Oppression works in these ridiculous ways, which provides all these narratives, and this is what I'm talking about. That's why narrative is really important, because if you really start to question the heart of narrative, it all falls away. How many people in this room are really free, like feel free that they can interact with who they want to? There's all these layers of fear and baggage, and to talk, you must confront that. You know, in Igbo, we say, the person who asks questions never gets lost. You may get a slap, but you never get lost. And so it's better you ask a question that gets you a slap than that you spend your life not knowing, do you know? So that's important. That's the only way to sustain a community, is to just agree. And also, like, you just sometimes you just have to tell them, you just have to agree. You know, it's just like being a man. I'm born with a certain privilege, just being a man, regardless of my race. I walk in front of a classroom and I can perform my job in a way a woman cannot. People will not tolerate certain kinds of assertiveness or even aggressiveness or foul language from a woman, right? So for me to pretend that I don't walk with that privilege, it doesn't mean I'm going to go around mea culpa in for being a man, but I cannot pretend I don't wield that power. So sometimes when stuff happens, you have to say, you know what, it's true, I fucked up, I'm a man. Just own it. That's all. It's easy. It's easier than you think, actually. Because, you know, the funny thing is sometimes when you own stuff, the worst thing that happens is people are like, I'm glad you said that. Let's go get a drink. When I did my first MA, it was in London. It was in gender and culture. I was the only man in a class of 80 women, 20 of them who were radical feminists, who protested my enrollment in the program on the grounds that my presence was rape. And so every day in class, I would put up my hand for like the first 2 months, and these 20 women would roll their eyes and go, oh, fucking rapist wants to talk. I had just come from Nigeria. I didn't really understand a lot of what the gender was going on. So, but I stuck it. And after 2 months, we would go to the pub together. After they did that, they'd be leaving and be like, "You want to come to the pub, racist?" And I'd be like, "Sure." I mean, and so that's basically what we did. And so. Sometimes the worst thing is not that bad. That makes sense. All right. Thank you very much.